This week, what U.S. national security officials are warning headed up to the election and beyond.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the FBI have been expressing concern about the possibility for violence as Americans get ready to go to the polls in next week's presidential election.
And a changing face of Americans and how the rise in racial and ethnic divisions are impacting the race for president.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
We will come together based on what we all know we have in common, and we will not let those people who are motivated by hate separate us or make us feel fear.
Join us on The Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington.
And I'm Scott Walterman. The United States continues to become more ethnically diverse, and as it does, the white majority continues to shrink. It's become a major theme in the presidential campaign.
They hate our country, because who would want to have millions of people coming into our country? Many of them are murderers. Many of them are terrorists. Many of them are gang members from the street, MS-13, and almost worse. You know, the Venezuelan gangs are almost worse. And these countries are taking their prisons, and they're taking their prison population, putting them in buses, and bringing them to our border. Venezuela's got half their prison population has been brought to the United States of America and dumped like we're a garbage can for their people.
What Donald Trump has never understood is that e pluribus unum, out of many, one, isn't just a phrase on a dollar bill. It is a living truth about the heart of our nation.
With the election just days away, the outcome could signal the direction of the nation for years to come.
Let's get some perspective on America's changing demographics and what it means for the country's future. Joining us now is Michael Ezra, professor of American Multicultural Studies at Sonoma State University.
Thanks so much for speaking. I always appreciate your perspective.
You're welcome.
So we're in an interesting time here. We went from an African-American president to Donald Trump, and then the first Black American Indian vice president, and potentially now the president. And as America obviously continues to become more ethnically and racially diverse, we also seem to be very more and more divided on the issues of immigration and race equality. Obviously, a very big major theme in this election coming up in just a couple of days, and also a lot of hate, rise in hate crime. What do you think is happening here with our changing demographics?
Yeah, I think that when you look at the presidential election in the context of our world at the current moment, it might seem like the most important election of our times, or that the issues are unprecedented, or that, for example, hate crimes are on the rise. But if you were to compare the political scene now to, like, you know, 1880 or whatever, then it would seem like hate crimes, you know, have been minimized over the years. And if you look at these elections in much larger contexts, you can see them as part of cycles. And I'm not sure right now if in 2024 we're going through some kind of racial realignment in which how different racial groups line up with the political parties shifts and changes at all, or if the current cycles will play out as they usually do in history.
When you say realignment, what do you mean?
It's hard to know actually who's going to vote how, and we never really truly find out because exit polling is limited. But historically, what we see now is that the Democratic Party gets about half, almost a little less than half of its votes from non-white voters. And the Republican Party gets about 10% of its votes from non-white voters, and about 90% of its votes from whites. at one time in U.S. history, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party essentially split the black vote. In 1960, Richard Nixon said, if I had only gotten 10% more of the black vote, I would have won this election. And he published an article saying that in Ebony magazine. So there was a time when the Republican Party had the idea that the strategy would be to peel off those newly franchised black voters in the 1960s and play off the animosity that black voters had towards the Democratic Party in the 1960s as the racist party. But then the Democratic Party realigned in the 1960s. It backed strong civil rights legislation behind Lyndon Johnson, who was, you know, originally like a Southern Democrat. And as a result, the Republican Party was able to capture the legislation, and they joined the Republican Party, which then dominated election cycles for 20 years. You had Republican presidents in 5 out of 6 elections following Johnson's presidency. So that's what I mean by a realignment.
Well, in that regard, you can see Hispanic voters for sure drifting to the right.
So in 2016, if you looked at Donald Trump's original run for president, I mean, he was standing at 1% in the Iowa caucuses. And the Republican Party leadership, like the Republican National Committee, I mean, all of whom quit once Trump won, didn't back him at all. The Republican Party elite in 2016 backed 3 candidates that I can think of, the favorites. There was Jeb Bush, there was Ted Cruz, there was Marco Rubio. Cruz and Rubio's ties to Latino voters are obvious. Jeb Bush, though, also speaks fluent Spanish, is married to a Latina, majored in Latin American studies in college, did term abroad in Latin America. So he has strong ties to Latinos and was the governor of Florida, and you have to have some ties to Latinos to win that state. So the strategy of the Republican Party, I think, was to try to peel off as many Latino voters using conservatism as the common thread from the Democratic Party. But instead, what happened was that Trump's anti-immigrant message, and in some ways anti-Latino immigrant message, won the day with Republican voters. So that realignment got stalled. There is talk of some drift by Latinos towards Trump, but we don't know actually how the election is going to play out. But the Republican Party, if Trump loses, almost certainly will resume that strategy of not just playing to a white base, but trying to expand that base as the only way to stay competitive in national elections. They have lost the popular vote in 6 out of the last 7 elections, with only George Bush in 2004 winning. So this is actually a dire situation for the Republican Party in terms of mobilizing the national electorate. Issues that used to work for them, like abortion, which Reagan used to rally a 49-state win in 1984, is a loser for them in 2020 and 2022.
Right. And the rise in immigration and anti-immigration, you know, talking about deporting millions of immigrants, just this anti-immigrant sentiment, it's sort of contrary to the founding of the country. If you look back, you know, nation of immigrants, what would you say to people that, you know, would be sort of a miscalculation as to the impact of immigrants on the country as a whole?
I think that unless you really study immigration and have your own metrics for what qualifies as progress or positive impact, it would be really hard for anyone to make a reasoned statement beyond their own personal ideology of what the overall net result of immigration has been to the United States in historical context as well as in the present. And I think there is the tendency by some people to make a hero out of the 19th century immigrant, but not necessarily the 20th or 21st century immigrant. And something to some degree that has to do with the racial remix of U.S. immigration. You had in the 1890s, early 20th century, up until like the 19-teens, about 90% of immigrants to the United States coming from Europe. And not all of them were accepted in equal measure. But nowadays, you have a reversal of it. About 90% of immigration to the United States comes from outside Europe. So you have kind of a different looking immigrant coming to the United States. You have the United States population changing in terms of white versus non-white. The census has been overcounting whites for quite a long time. Combined with differing birth rates and racial groups and immigration, you have a different racial mix of the United States. Whites will no longer be 50% of the population relatively soon. And why most Americans do believe that is not a negative per se, there is a portion of the electorate, about 10 to 20% of the electorate, more strongly correlating with whites, that does express openly fear of the changing racial demographic of the United States. And in Donald Trump's case, there is the belief, I think, of a lot of people that he doesn't like immigrants. And you hear his initial run for president, the first speech that he does. And he talks about, you know, some of them are rapists. They come from Mexico. They come from Asia. They probably come from the Middle East. So you would think Donald Trump, you know, is anti-immigrant. But if you look at Donald Trump's personal life, you know, all four of his grandparents came from Europe. Two out of his three wives came from Europe. The people he surrounds himself with are immigrants. So Donald Trump seems to have benefited from and enjoys the company of immigrants from Europe, but not necessarily from other parts of the world. And that does indicate that, you know, at least in some of his messaging, race has something to do, immigration in some ways is a stand-in for a racial worldview, a racial ideology.
Well, to pair that with what you were saying about early immigration from Europe, you hear that when people say, oh, well, you know, they're Irish or they're Italian. Well, my people came in legally, but they did not. They got on a boat, they landed at Ellis Island, they applied for asylum, and then disappeared into Manhattan. It's the same thing, pretty much, that's happening on the southern border.
There are many parallel myths between how people speak about immigration back in the day, so to speak, and how they speak about it now. And, right, there is the myth that everyone who came here, you know, prior to 1924 or whatever, came here legally. And there is the idea that most people came here with nothing and yet still managed to make it. So why are we providing, you know, safety nets for people who come here now? But the truth is that America needed immigrants to come in the early 20th century to help build up American cities and industry. And there were a lot of incentives for people to come. And a lot of people who may have come here perhaps undercapitalized came here with skills that what they were unable to practice and benefit from so much in their home country, but would be able to be a stonemason or a carpenter or a pipe fitter or a steel worker in the United States, where those kinds of opportunities for industrialization came slightly after European industrialization.
And now it seems like a portion of our population is vilifying immigrants as somehow taking jobs away from people. And it also seems like there's a rise in white nationalism, not just even here in the U.S., but globally, as well as, you know, African-American voters in particular being the target of voter suppression efforts that could, you know, dilute their voting strengths. Do you see that also as a factor in all of this?
Well, if you listen to some people, ultimately what this election will come down to is Democrats getting out the black vote. Generally speaking, voting rights experts do talk about a case called Shelby versus Holder from 2013 in the Supreme Court, in which an Alabama county was able to successfully sue to get tenets of the Voting Rights Act changed, which leads to closures of voting places and, you know, shorter hours or closures of DMVs, and in some cases, voter ID laws that are somewhat difficult to pursue if you don't already own a government-issued ID. It's not as easy as people would think. In one-third of Texas counties, you need an ID to vote, but those same counties don't offer any place for a resident of that county to get a government-issued ID. So in places where there's like a narrow margin of victory or loss, like Atlanta, like Detroit, like Milwaukee, like Philadelphia, in those swing states, it's very important for Democrats to mobilize the black vote, make sure that no voters are suppressed, make sure that the lines keep moving, make sure that the machines work. But because there are so few places that actually count in terms of a narrow margin of victory deciding this election, just as a guess, I feel like, you know, any major political party with an active legal branch and ties to the judiciary and a strong ground game sees what's coming ahead and knows what the general voter suppression tactics are and has countermeasures to battle them.
Last big picture question. You mentioned cycles, and I have this cycle theory where we become complacent over long periods of time, and every 40 or so years, we face a crisis that we have to rise to. McCarthyism, Watergate, now. And we do. We rise as Americans to the occasion.
What is interesting to me during this time period is the kind of contradictory messaging that individuals, institutions, and let's just say groups of people exude. You have the Washington Post, whose slogan became in the Trump era, "Democracy dies in darkness," who then refuses to endorse. And I actually think one of the biggest stories of this whole election cycle is probably going to be the takedown of the owner of Amazon, who will, you know, who has been posing on a yacht with muscularity and with a very glamorous wife, you know, trying to adopt a traditional kind of manly image, who instead shrunk from the challenge of Trumpism. And I think that kind of the parodying and lampooning of that kind of hypocrisy is going to play out over the next 4 years.
Right, because the editorial board was ready to endorse Kamala Harris, and then suddenly they were not allowed.
Yeah, the newspaper, you know, has endorsed the candidate for quite a long time and now didn't, and that has raised eyebrows. And in terms of culture, 250,000 people canceling their subscriptions to the Washington Post in a matter of days, 10 to 12% of their readership. To me, that's actually a sign of energy on the left.
All right. We really appreciate your perspective. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
Michael Ezra, professor of American Multicultural Studies at Sonoma State University.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London with Scott Walterman.
I will say and repeat what I think most people understand. In America, in a democracy, we should have no room for, nor should we ever condone any form of political violence. In a democracy, people will debate, people will disagree, but not resort to violence. And everyone should speak out about that, including and especially anybody who's running for president of the United States.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, speaking after the assassination attempt on her rival in the election, former President Donald Trump. Since the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol, conspiracies and accusations that the 2020 election was rigged have continued.
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has continued to insist the last election was stolen from him, and ahead of next week's election, Trump has been making similar unfounded statements.
But I hope you can watch, and you're all over the place. Watch for the voter fraud, because we win. Without voter fraud, we win so easily. Hopefully we're going to win anyway, but we want to keep it down. You can keep it down just by watching.
Some voters are too nervous to even put campaign signs in their lawns.
People just don't want to, even Trump supporters, they just don't want to hear it from their neighbors. They don't want to take the risk of somebody confronting them or tearing down their lawn sign or whatever might happen.
The deep divisions across the country have been fertile ground for a myriad of conspiracy theories that U.S. officials fear could lead to violence by domestic extremists.
FBI Director Christopher Wray at a congressional hearing last year on domestic terror threats.
As I've said before, the greatest threat we face on the terrorism front here in the homeland is from what are effectively lone actors or small cells. And whether you're talking about a domestic violent extremist acting in furtherance of some ideological goal or a homegrown violent extremist looking to advance the interests of a foreign terrorist organization, these actors often move very quickly from radicalization to action.
Joining us now for details on the latest Homeland Security warnings is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Jeff, we're hearing, and you have been in looking into this, some intelligence bulletin from Homeland Security that have been showing a rising threat of extremists creating potential violence and chaos to disrupt the election, next week's presidential election. What can you tell us about what you're hearing?
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, other security officials at the state and local level across the country for some time have been expressing concern about the possibility for violence as Americans get ready to go to the polls in next week's presidential election, which also includes a bunch of state and local elections up and down the line. And there have been warnings put out repeatedly over the last several months. Most recently, last month, the Department of Homeland Security issued its 2025 Homeland Security Assessment, and in it, it specifically warned that what it calls domestic violent extremists, that is, Americans who hold extremist views, it said will pose the most significant physical threat to government officials and voters, and also elections-related personnel and infrastructure. That assessment said that targets could include polling places, ballot drop boxes, voter registration sites, campaign events, political party offices, and vote counting sites. Now, in conjunction with that, DHS and the FBI have been amplifying those warnings and have issued a series of non-public security bulletins to police agencies across the country. Some of these were obtained by a group called Property of the People, which describes itself as a nonprofit group that is dedicated to government transparency. It's posted some of those bulletins online, and some of them cite growing calls on social media for attacks on ballot collection boxes. There have also been warnings about calls for civil war, and some of the bulletins say that those calls and magnified after the July 13th attempted assassination of former president and Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. So there's been a lot on their plate, and they've been looking at that, and they've been warning about it. There is a heightened sense of urgency to make sure that the elections are safe.
It's not just election day, right?
There are a number of warnings within this singular warning about the election. Some of the warnings, as I mentioned, focused on attacks on ballot drop boxes or ballot collection boxes. And just on Monday, there were two attacks, one in Portland, Oregon, and one across the river in Vancouver, Washington, two cities in the U.S., where somebody, according to law enforcement officials, took an incendiary device, put it in the ballot drop boxes, and set them on fire. Two boxes were attacked in one. Just a couple of ballots were thought to have been destroyed, but in the other could be much more. And that follows an attack last week in Phoenix, Arizona, in the state of Arizona, where somebody has been arrested now for trying to set fire to a mailbox in order to damage ballots. So some of this is already taking place. In addition to the potential domestic threat, the U.S. intelligence agencies that focus more on external threats from foreign adversaries warned last week that they suspect and they have reason to believe that both Russia and also possibly Iran are moving ahead with plans to foment and inspire election-related violence as the elections take place.
Jeff Selden, VOA's national security correspondent, thanks so much for the info.
Anytime.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thanks so much for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.